Welcome to the Lucas Miles Show. I'm your host, Lucas Miles. Welcome to the Lucas Miles Show. My name is Lucas Miles, and I hope you're a fan of eschatology because today we're talking with my guest, Joel Richardson, author and really end times expert. Joel is just a wealth of resource on everything from early church history to study of the prophets in scripture, and of course, all things eschatology as well. I mentioned a couple of his books in the interview, so make sure and check those out. And Joel and I just had a great time really diving into, in many ways, the basics of the different views of eschatology. He helps break down some of the terms like postmillennialism and things that people stumble over, and really presents them in a way that's simple, easy to understand. And I think that this is one of those things where it's not about so much telling you how you should believe, but really equipping you with the skills to be able to really go to the Word yourself and be able to start framing your own view of how it is that you believe that Scripture, you know, presents these things. And I love this quote that I heard. I can't remember where I originally heard it, but 15% of everything I believe is wrong. I'm just not sure what 15% it is. And I think that when we're talking about something like eschatology, that's a really important mindset to carry. You know, we all see in part, but I think Joel sees a little bit more than the rest of us. And just to tell you how nice Joel is, I made a mistake during the interview and I said Clement of Antioch rather than Clement of Rome, despite the fact that I had just finished literally reading Clement's letters. And Joel didn't even correct me. That's how kind he is. But before we get in the interview, here's a little bit of a word about our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Cove. Head over to covesmart.com to find out more. My house is protected by Cove, 5-star home security system without contracts or headaches. Head over there and you can check out their system, all the different products that they have, from door sensors, window sensors, home cameras. You can tie it in with an app. I can pull up my house right now, flip through the cameras, see what my dog and cat are doing, make sure everybody's safe. I travel a lot. It's a really great thing for, you know, our family. I think you're going to enjoy it as well. Head over to covesmart.com. Want to thank them for their sponsorship. And with that, here is the episode.
Joel Richardson. Welcome to the Lucas Miles Show. I am here with my guest today, Joel Richardson. Joel, welcome to the program.
Lucas, thanks for having me on.
So for my listeners, I first read one of your books maybe like 5 years ago. I came across Mystery. Is it Mystery Babylon? Is that...
Yeah, that would have been a few years ago, or maybe Mideast Beast 5 years ago.
Might have been that one was the first one. Yeah, so I've read a couple of your books. Had a chance to kind of browse through one of your newer ones, Mount Sinai in Arabia, and obviously you have the Mystery of Catastrophe that's out now as well. And you know, I'll say this on your behalf: I really see you as an expert on in times, specifically in relationship to Israel, Old Testament prophecy, and then I just think you do a great job, which is one of the reasons I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, on navigating all of the different, just numerous beliefs there are regarding end times theology, but with respect. And, you know, it's easy when somebody doesn't agree with you to go, you know, you're an idiot for thinking this way. And, you know, but you have a lot of grace in how you approach people. And I think still a degree of open-mindedness. I've heard you say, I used to think this and now I see it this way on certain issues. And I think that those are all signs of somebody that is really working to rightly divide the word and to help, you know, not only others, but yourself kind of grow towards the truth. And so I just, you know, I'm excited to have you on the show, and I wish it was under better circumstances from this whole quarantine world that we're in, but I think we make the best of it as believers. So welcome, and would love to dive into some end time theology and really try to maybe bring up some things for our listeners that that might challenge them to go deeper.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I appreciate the compliments. Obviously, you know, theology is a funny world, but eschatology in particular can be a very funny world. And it's also a place that a lot of highly, highly opinionated teachers tend to dwell. And so I definitely do have some strong opinions, as most people do. On the other hand, I think when it comes particularly to future speculative eschatology, if there is one arena of theology that we need to be humble concerning, it's definitely speculative future eschatology, things that haven't been fulfilled yet for sure. And unfortunately, that's not always the case, but definitely trying my best to walk in that character.
So I heard you say here recently on your podcast, which I've been enjoying and would highly recommend to anybody. When did you start that, by the way?
Just recently, actually. It's part of a larger ecosystem, one ministry. I'm involved behind the scenes. I give support and leadership to a few different ministries that are primarily working in the Muslim world, in the Middle East. And so FAI, Frontier Alliance International, one of the ministries I've partnered with. And so both in mission and in messaging, we're very much on the same page. So FAI launched an app, and we're just putting out all types of content from TV programs to teaching to podcasts and so forth. So that just launched a couple months ago, and so I just started the podcast just recently.
No, that's awesome. I've listened to probably three or four. I got a Doberman. I take her on a walk, and I've been putting on the AirPods and listening to the podcast while I'm walking. So I've been enjoying that. So I heard you say on one here recently, and I hope I don't misquote you, that the overwhelming evidence that we see in the early church points us towards a historic premillennialism. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at, now, let me just say this, the early church writers are a funny subject. It really does require a lifetime of dedication to patristics to be an expert, and so I don't claim to be an expert, and there's going to be a lot of debate in this field, but let me just say that I think it's pretty much consensus that the vast majority of the earliest of the early church writers were what you would call historic premillennialists. Now, it is an interesting study in terms of history, the development of ideas in the church. What happened is during this whole period, right, you had the influence of the Hellenizers, the Greek philosophical worldview that was clashing with a Hebraic or a biblical worldview. And the headquarters of, let's say, the Hellenistic influence was Alexandria, Egypt. So it's interesting that by about the third century, you start seeing a handful of particular teachers, all of whom lived in Alexandria, all of whom who had formerly been Neoplatonists of some kind, essentially students of Plato and Greek philosophy, who are trying to reconcile their, again, Greek worldview with a biblical worldview. And so while the early church writers, again, yeah, they were historic pre-mill, then you had Clement of Alexandria, you had Origen, and eventually, ultimately, Augustine really came from that philosophical school, so to speak. And that's the time in church history where they really started embracing an allegorical spiritualization of many of the biblical prophecies, but particularly those that spoke of a physical, restored, redeemed earth. And this is really where amillennialism, or as our British friends like to say, amillennialism, crept into the church. And so it's helpful to understand just the history, a development of ideas, where they came from in the church, and how we got to where we are today.
And so what you would say in studying people like Irenaeus or Clement of Antioch, that you would see this historical premillennialism in terms of their theology?
So, and there's going to be a variety, there's going to be a range of opinions among these guys, certainly. But yeah, Justin Martyr, Papias, the fragments that we have of Papias, folks like Irenaeus, Hippolytus, Lactantius, Victorinus.
What awesome names, by the way. We have such boring names compared to these guys. They knew how to do it.
Yeah. I met someone in a restaurant recently. They had a little kid, and his name was Maximus. I thought that was pretty good.
So just define for us, because I imagine there's somebody, I don't cover, I think this is the first episode of my show. I've done over 100 episodes that we've really dove into in times. I work a lot in the Hollywood space and kind of crossover between church and media world. So define these terms a little bit for somebody, for them to understand. What is historic premillennialism? What is amillennialism? Help us break down maybe in just kind of a short snippet of how do we make sense of those words?
So it's actually pretty simple. Big words, they're not that complicated. Premillennialism simply means that Jesus returns previous to, before, the millennium. So the millennium is a period spoken of in the book of Revelation, chapter 20. It's a 1,000-year golden era of Christ's rule. So premillennialism sees that as literal. Jesus will return and establish a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ. Now, for what it's worth, the biblical prophets speak abundantly of the millennium. They just don't call it that. So the critics of premillennialism will say, well, it's only mentioned there in Revelation 20. It's only mentioned by name in Revelation 20. It's described in great detail throughout the prophets. The prophets speak of a time period that is much better than this present age that we're in. You know, the lion will lie down with the lamb, they beat their swords into plowshares, this type of thing. But yet it's not perfect. It's not the eternal state. There's still death. There's still a measure of rebellion. So this becomes the basis for the, again, pan-biblical understanding of a millennial reign of Christ. Now, amillennialism essentially means no millennium, which is to say, it's not that they don't believe in a millennium, they just don't believe it's literal. They believe it's, again, allegorical and metaphorical, and we're in it now. We're in the millennium now. This is it. It's a spiritually realized kingdom. Christ is on the throne in heaven, sitting at the right hand of the Father, ruling over everything. And that's amillennialism. Now, post-millennialism, just to throw in one more, is more of a later development, started with some of the later reformers.
So for this idea of kind of this post-millennialism, it would be the mindset of we're, you know, the church is going to conquer these seven mountains and, you know, of influence, and we're going to keep rising and getting brighter and brighter and brighter. And then, you know, talk to me a little bit about, because there's this other derivative of this, which would be preterism and this connection with AD 70, which, you know, I've seen a lot of my peers, you know, maybe drift off into. So where do you see that originating from? And can you break that down for us a little bit in understanding?
So preterism simply means history, historical. And so preterism essentially holds in varying degrees that many of the prophecies concerning the end times have already been fulfilled primarily in the events that surrounded the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That really some of the more extreme preterists actually say that Jesus has already returned invisibly or spiritually in judgment, that all prophecy was really fulfilled. And you've even got some folks, I would call them hyper-preterists, they would call themselves consistent preterists, that actually say we're already living in the eternal state. This is it. And I always like to make the joke, because it's a good demonstration of what we're dealing with. I was in Scotland and I was teaching on these things. And after I spoke, again, defending premillennialism, this little Scottish woman came up to me and she said, "Oh, Joel," I can't do a Scottish accent, but you know, "you're so right. You're so right." She said, "because if the millennium is now, if we are in the millennium now, then the millennium really sucks." And I said, she gets it. This lady gets it. You know, she understands.
And that was pre-quarantine.
So this is the, this was a couple of years ago. So, you know, the point is, you can come up with some pretty serious extremes of this preterism. But the idea is this, Lucas, is I'm going to jump forward and jump back. So in the 80s, you had a theologian named Anthony Hokema, or Hokema. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. And Anthony is an amillennialist, and he explained, he goes, listen, I'm an, you know, dyed in the wool amillennialist, but the scriptures do teach that after Jesus returns, our inheritance is a very corporal, substantial, physical inheritance. It's back to the garden. It's the restoration of the garden. And theologians like N.T. Wright, in his book Surprised by Hope, he articulates the same thing. He says, look, this idea, this popular idea that the goal of Christianity is someday to escape the body, escape the shell, and to essentially go to heaven and be a spirit forever, that's thoroughly unbiblical. Again, that emanates from a Greek philosophical worldview. So although much of the church throughout history did hold to this kind of spiritualized inheritance vision, since the 1980s, even most amillennialists embrace the idea of the restoration of the garden. Now, here's where preterists and amillennialists or postmillennialists who are preterists differ from premillennialists. The other side of the package, again, Anthony Hokima, N.T. Wright, they are correct. We are waiting for the resurrection of the body, the restoration of the earth, the restoration of all things, the restoration of the planet, the renewal of the planet, so to speak. However, the other side of the component that they leave out is the scriptures also say that the kingdom of Israel will be restored. So it's the Garden of Eden, yea, it's the restored garden, it's the restored kingdom of David. Mix those two together, just add all kinds of fireworks and glory, and you're just beginning to get a picture of what the age to come is like. Now, the amillennialists, again, the postmillennialists, the preterists, they'll agree with the corporal side of our inheritance, but reject the idea that God is still going to restore Israel. And so because the scriptures speak of all of these things, they have to find a mechanism to essentially write off so many prophecies. And so they actually put the fulfillment of all of these things in history back in 70 AD. And the reason, this is one of the issues that I fight against, and I do get very opinionated concerning. And the reason is because the ramifications of this boil down to essentially saying that the time in history when Israel suffered its greatest defeat, it's often called by historians the first Holocaust. To say that the first Holocaust was essentially the fulfillment of Jewish prophetic expectation, that's a really perverse thing to say. It's like saying, look, the Lord gave you these promises. He made these covenants with you. He gave you the prophets. He gave you the scriptures. He made promises that someday the Messiah is going to come, and he is going to deliver you from the oppression of the Gentiles, of the nations. You're going to, no longer will you, you know, your neighbors, will they be pricking briars and thorns, but the God will be your God. You will be his people. You will be planted in the land. All of these things, they've been waiting for these promises. They've been holding out. And God goes, actually, what I meant is you're all going to be destroyed. Most of you are going to be killed, and you're going to be kicked out of your country forever. That's a racist theology. It's really offensive. Now, Christians don't think of it because we are very Christian-centric. We don't think of how offensive that is to Jews, but it's very offensive, and it's offensive to the biblical testimony.
I mean, it's really, I'm sure you would agree and probably would say this, is that it's a form of supersessionism, and it is a, you know, it's essentially just a replacement theology. I mean, how do you deal with, you know, is there a path in Scripture to not downgrading the inheritance we have as Gentile believers and still honoring the biblical prophetic restoration of Israel?
Yeah, and this is the thing, is a lot of people feel as though if you allow for Israel to still have future grace, that his promises allow for future grace for Israel, that somehow that makes us second-class citizens. And it's just not true. We're not second-class citizens. We've always been part of the story. You look at the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12. It's the verse that everyone loves to quote who is pro-Israel. I will bless those that bless thee and curse those that curse thee. You know, you get John Hagee. Amen, brother. You know, God and America and Israel, you know, match made in heaven type of thing. And, you know, of course, this does tend to turn off a lot of, I'll say, younger millennials or whoever comes after the millennials. It tends to turn them off. But the reality is the next portion of the verse is, and I will bless all nations through you. So, again, you have to include both components of that verse. I will, the Lord said, I will bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you. And in you, all the Gentiles will be blessed. So it's always been part of his plan. We're not second-class citizens, but in a way, we are a secondary narrative.
Sure.
From a biblical framework, we are a secondary narrative. And it's offensive to people. They say, well, I wouldn't have chosen to have done it that way. Well, of course, you're a Gentile. You know, it's offensive when Jesus says, I've only been called to the lost sheep of Israel. And the woman says, yeah, but I mean, even the dogs get crumbs. You know, that can be offensive. There is an ethnocentric nature to the narrative. And when I say ethnocentric, we could say there's a racist element to the narrative, but it's a positive racism. God called a man named Abram, became Abraham. He turned him into a family, turned that family into a nation, turned that nation into a holy womb that would bring forth the Messiah. And through the Messiah, every tongue, tribe, people, and nation would be blessed. But here's the thing is he never did away with his original platform, his original family that he's said he's going to bless. He's never done away with that, but he's flung the doors wide open to all of us. And so we shouldn't be offended. We should just say, look, if in your wisdom, this is how you've chosen to do it, Lord, you're God, I'm not. And, you know, and if I'm offended, it's probably because I misunderstand things. And some of that is just the fault of those who communicate it wrongly. But some of it is just unnecessary offense.
I hear a lot of people bring up the reference, this very obscure passage in the works of Josephus about that during the siege of Jerusalem, there was people that claimed that they saw Christ riding, you know, in the clouds. And that seems to become like this backbone, almost like annexed into scripture, sort of, you know, ancient writing that I see those that hold to an AD 70 sort of preterist, things were completed at this point, view grab a hold of. Have you done any study of that particular passage, or do you have any, you know, thoughts on that?
I'll be honest with you. I'm not familiar with any reference in Josephus to them saying they saw Jesus in the clouds. I am familiar with them saying they saw armies running around on the clouds. And that's usually what is pointed to. They go, oh no, it was a vision that many had. They looked up in the clouds and they saw people, armies running around on the clouds. And that becomes a huge supporting text, supporting passage in Flavius Josephus for preterism. But even when you look at that passage, it says nothing about the armies of heaven coming and defeating. See, this is the thing, is consistently from the beginning to the end, the prophets tell a narrative which says that the Gentiles will invade Israel, invade Jerusalem, and the Messiah will come and deliver his people Israel from the Gentiles. Okay? Now, from the preterist perspective, what N.T. Wright says, you see, he says essentially God flipped the narrative. The real enemy was not the Gentiles. The Gentiles were the Lord's rod of chastisement that he used against Israel. The real judgment was on the leaders of Israel. And so you have this consistent narrative that God is going to deliver Israel from the pagans. And the preterist narrative essentially says, no, God executed judgment against Israel. He used Rome as his rod of punishment, and he destroyed Israel. And you just go, this is such a radical rewriting of the narrative that it should be unacceptable to anyone who understands the biblical narrative. The problem is, including theologians, we tend to be very Old Testament illiterate. So it sounds good. When they lay it out, you know, they can make a very effective case until they get their hands dirty and start actually reading the prophets and understanding the narrative that came before. You can't begin with the New Testament and then reverse engineer the narrative. You have to begin at the foundation and work your way forward. And if you're completely perverting the story, well, then it's probably not the right story.
No, that's good. That's good. What would you say to somebody out there, Joel, who is maybe going, you know, look, I've wanted to get into this. They don't consider themselves necessarily a theologian, but for their own personal relationship and journey with Christ, where would you suggest somebody starting in developing their, for lack of a better term, sort of their own eschatology or understanding of biblical eschatology?
Well, I hate to do this, but one book that's great is my book, When a Jew Rules the World. And, you know, because I cover such a broad overview of a lot of these issues. And I explain that it really is about God's faithfulness. Is God faithful or is he not? When you read his promises, when you see what he said he was going to do, the question really boils down to is, has he fulfilled those things? Will he fulfill those things? Or has he been punking us all along? Because that's really the conclusion you would have to come to is, I'll give you an example. I won't say his name, but a theologian, very well respected, amillennialist. And he says, listen, if your father promised you that someday he was going to buy you a buggy, he's going to buy you a buggy. This is early 20th century, early 1900s. He's going to buy you a buggy someday when you graduate from high school. But by the time that you graduate from high school, some basic cars have come out. So rather than buying you a horse-drawn buggy, he buys you a car. He says he fulfilled his promise literally. And everyone goes, oh, okay. So basically, you know, what the preterists and so forth are saying is that God's going to give us, he's going to fulfill his promises, but it's way different than what he actually promised. But it's better, so who cares? That's the argument. And my point is saying, no, it's not literally. Just because it's better doesn't mean that he fulfilled his promises literally. If he said, I'm going to give you a buggy, and he gives you a Tesla, he has not literally fulfilled his promises. He's blessed you, and that's wonderful. But when God specifically says, I am going to restore the throne of David, multiple times, David, I promise you, someone from your lineage will reign on your throne forever. I will raise up the fallen tabernacle of David, and he will rule on Mount Zion. And then God comes along and goes, well, I didn't really mean that. What I meant is it's in a metaphorical, spiritual way. He's reigning from heaven. I didn't really mean a literal kingdom, this type of thing. Even if you say it's better than the original promise, I go, it's still different. And the bottom line is either God is faithful to his promises as he made them to his people, or he's not faithful. And so this really, it's very important that we understand what is at stake in these theological debates. It's not really just debating theology for the sake of it. It affects our witness concerning who God is. Is he essentially the middle-aged man who gets a divorce because his wife is whatever, you know, he gets tired of his wife, and he moves on and gets a new model? Because that's essentially what the supersessionist framework says, is that God had a bride, he divorced the bride, she was a whore, he divorced her, and he got himself a new bride, which is the church. And I go, is that the God that we want to represent to the world? And I would say no. Rather, he is the God of the prophet Hosea. You know, Hosea, go marry a whore and remain faithful to her. And except God is Hosea in the narrative. And we're the whore for all intents and purposes. You know, because we as the church can say, oh, well, Israel was so unfaithful. They sinned too many times. But we, on the other hand, we just celebrate his mercies every morning.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. So we just got a couple more minutes here, and I want to be respectful of your time as well. This is one of those questions that you ask and you realize you can't do it in probably just a couple minutes. But from your standpoint, you know, there's always, you know, predictions and people looking for things. Is there anything that, you know, when you're kind of saying, okay, based upon the study that you've done, here are the benchmarks that you're looking for as we, you know, wait the return of Jesus?
Well, this is dangerous waters, of course. I would say in a real general way, Israel really is the barometer. We have to understand that all of the classic signs of the return of Jesus, the Antichrist, the mark of the beast, the tribulation, wars, rumors of wars, plagues, pestilences, all of these things, those are the things that everyone are fascinated by, and they're important. But Jesus contextualizes them. He says, listen, these are the birth pains. And we as believers, our focus is not on the birth pains. Our focus is on the birth and having to raise the child, you know, the king and his kingdom, the return of Jesus and his kingdom. That's our focus. The Lord wants us to understand these things. Now, that said, the end times, the birth pains, what are they about? It's very simple. The closer that we get to the time of the birth, the closer that we get to the time of the restoration of all things, by which all the prophets have spoken, the more that Satan will rage. And the primary magnet of controversy is the people in the land of Israel. Yes, it's Christians globally. We are in his targets as well, in his sights as well. But like a tropical storm, you know, it starts out off the coast of down in the Gulf off the coast of Florida, and then it swirls. Next thing you know, the whole East Coast is just pulled into this thing. That is Israel. That's the storm that's coming. And so Israel really is the barometer. The more that we see the hatred of the Jewish people rise, the more that we know we're getting closer. And so in a very, very general sense, I would say that it boils down to the satanic controversy over God's promises, the satanic controversy over Zion. When Jesus returns in Isaiah 34, he says, "The day of my vengeance has come, the year of my redemption has come." And he says, it's for the controversy of Zion. And so that's actually and continues to be a big part of the reason for his glorious return.
No, that's awesome. I appreciate you handled that very well for, as you mentioned, as dangerous waters as a question like that can be as we dive into those topics. So, Joel, thank you so much for taking some time with us on the show today. If people want to find out more about you or check out some of your resources, where's the best place to do that at?
So I'm at joelstrumpet.com is my website, and I'm always causing trouble on Twitter at Joel7Richardson.
And I can vouch for that because I follow you on Twitter and I enjoy your posts, and it's a good mix of some humor, world events, and some prophecy. So good stuff there. So Joel, thank you so much. Been a real honor talking with you today, and welcome back anytime to the Lucas Miles Show.
All right, hit me up anytime. I appreciate it, Lucas.
Hey, just want to say thank you for listening to the Lucas Miles Show. Give us a shout out. We'd love to have you share this episode, help some other people find out about the program. If this was something that you enjoyed, make sure and tell a friend. And don't forget, hit us up on social media. You can find me at Mr. Lucas Miles. That's at Mr. Lucas Miles on both Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, actually, all three. So check us out there, and we got some amazing interviews coming up later this month. In the meantime, thanks for listening to the Lucas Miles Show.